Guys, I don't see Ed around here. Eric, did you remember to pack him?
Yeah, of course I remember to pack him.
Well, if you packed him in the suitcase, then where is he?
Oh, you wind up. Oh, yeah, that's a funny story. You're going to laugh.
Okay.
All right, so I was at the airport.
Uh-huh.
I was inexplicably flying here from Brooklyn with Ed.
Okay.
He was in the suitcase.
All right, where he should be.
And I put the suitcase down for a moment. I wanted to go to the magazine kiosk. And I came back, and the suitcase had been switched with a jewel thief suitcase.
A jewel thief suitcase.
A jewel thief. And we have these jewels now, but we don't have an Ed.
So let me get this straight. In what could only happen in a movie, you accidentally switched our suitcase with Ed with a suitcase full of jewels.
Uh-huh.
So now we have all these jewels, and someone has a suitcase full of Ed.
Yep.
Okay.
On an unrelated side note, we have some jewel thieves after us.
Where are the jewels, Mr. Takash?
I was wondering what that German guy was
doing
there.
Give us the jewels or we kill your lanky friend.
Eric, Alex, problems are solved.
Really?
Yeah, I kill those jewel thieves.
What?
Yeah, all right, Meyer.
All right, good job.
Wait, what about Ed? Yeah.
Oh, Ed, he's in these suitcases.
Suitcases?
Welcome to Ragnarok, your home of the Nerdpocalypse.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Ragnarok, episode 16. This is the first episode of a four-part special that we're calling Geek Century, and our alt title tonight is...
Our correct title.
Our correct title is Watch of the Doomhounds.
Watch out for those Doomhounds!
Because that's what you're supposed to do, because it's Watch of the Doomhounds.
Doomhounds.
We're still not really sure if the hounds are watching or if we're watching the hounds, but either way,
be both.
It's bad.
It's a mutual watch.
Either way, they're Doomhounds. So.
Anyway... I'm Ryan.
I'm Eric.
I'm Meyer.
And I'm Alex.
Anyhow, so we have a little bit of a retrospective prepared for you. We're going to take a look back at the geek and nerd culture from the years 1900 to 1925.
Before the words geek and nerd existed.
Yeah.
Well, the word geek existed, but it was a person who drank chicken's blood from a severed chicken head.
And so, the definition hasn't changed, actually.
It's true. So, Eric, pass me that chicken.
Right here.
Anyhow, each of us has taken a look at some element of proto-nerd culture from the early quarter century of the 20th century, and we're going to sit around and talk about them and the influences they had and whether or not they still hold up today.
It's like a literature history class, but fun.
Yeah.
Maybe. But fun.
Maybe.
Fun.
Maybe.
Those were the threatening points, because I keep forgetting we're a podcast without video.
We'll have one podcast, all mime podcast.
That would be the worst one.
So, Eric, what did you take a look at for us?
Well, I took a look at The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which everyone should be fairly familiar with, I would believe.
That's the one with the pumpkin, right?
Yeah, I think there's a pumpkin who's driving a taxi or something. Mm. That's what the story's... I researched the wrong thing.
All right, Eric needs 5 minutes. Continue.
Meanwhile.
All right, so to summarize, or for a brief synopsis, hopefully this is brief enough. Dorothy, a young orphan raised by her aunt and uncle, is caught in a tornado and deposited in the world of Oz, a colorful fantasy world. She's tasked with going to the Emerald City in order to find the Wizard of Oz, who will be able to return her to her home. Along the way, she meets new friends in the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion, all of whom need to meet the Wizard for their own reasons. The Wizard tells the group that they will get what they desire if they kill the evil, wicked Witch of the West.
This is the book, not the movie, right?
Right.
All right.
After facing a number of ordeals, the group is captured by the Witch. Oh, this is the spoiler alert, by the way, for you guys who don't know the story. So, spoiler alert... Dorothy defeats her with a bucket of water.
You know, I always wondered, she must just be smelly then. She can't...
If water people in Oz her. Don't sweat.
Oh.
She's still smelly.
Well, I mean...
She hangs out with flying monkeys.
That's true. You hang out with monkeys, you're gonna get pretty smelly.
But they probably throw, like, flying monkey shit.
But then again, she was a witch, so I doubt anyone ever told her she smelled.
Oh, no. I'm just... But that's not... That's not, you know, she still probably smelled.
Fair I mean, it doesn't matter really much anymore because she was defeated with a bucket of water.
Oh, so. It makes more sense than the ending of Lost.
So then the group returns to the wizard, who they find out is just a little old man. He doesn't have any powers, he's just a man. Like us.
We're not men.
Yes, we are. I'm a man.
We're young men. Not old men.
We're manly men.
No, we're not.
We're men in tights.
Tights.
Well, we're in tights, but we're not manly men.
Maybe you're not.
And tights are a useless item, which smoothly segues into, he gives the group some useless items to suit their desires, all of which work due to their belief in the power of the wizard. The wizard goes to bring Dorothy home in a hot air balloon, but it departs before she can get on. She ends up finding Glinda the Good Witch, who reveals that Dorothy had the power to go home all along by clicking the heels of the magic slippers she received upon arriving in Oz.
So the whole thing is a really obnoxious fetch quest, then?
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's like Animal Crossing. Yeah.
And wow.
Yes.
It's like, here, go to the other side of this world. Oh, nope, you could have done it right where you started from the entire time.
Why didn't you tell me?
Because I wanted you to deliver this letter.
It's like you were talking about before with Skyward Sword, right?
Exactly.
Obnoxious. Tell us a little bit about L. Frank Baum, the man who wrote the novels.
I think I'll do that right now. Lyman Frank Baum was born on May 15th, 1856.
I can understand why he abbreviated his first name.
I don't know, but if I had the same name as the guy who was in the Garfield strip for a while with the cool mustache, I wouldn't abbreviate it.
I feel like the guy in the Garfield strip was probably named after him.
Nah.
Yeah, fair, okay.
I talked to Jim Davis. He time traveled back in time. No, I won't continue. While the original Wonderful Wizard of Oz is his best-known work, he wrote 13 novel sequels to it, as well as 9 other fantasy novels, and a number of other works. There are about 55 novels altogether, plus 4 lost novels, 82 short stories, more than 200 poems, numerous scripts, and other miscellaneous writings. He was a very busy man.
That's a lot of words.
Yes.
That's very many words. And he also made a couple of attempts to bring his works to the stage and screen. So he was very prolific.
He was lazy, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Incredibly so.
Yeah. Get your shit together, man.
I'm sorry. Now, it's a...
Are you apologizing to?
You.
Oh, yes.
For
good.
Not telling him to get his shit together.
So how would you say that The Wizard of Oz, you know, influences, you know, us today?
Well, I mean, I think personally it's pretty obvious the influence of this story because, you know, it's been translated or adapted into 50 or so languages, and pretty much everyone knows the 1939 film version. I don't think I know anyone who hasn't seen it, honestly.
Blind people.
Well, I only know, like, 2 blind people.
Well, then you lied.
I'd like to personally apologize to the Ragnarok audience.
Eric, commit seppuku. We've all talked right. about this.
I have a sword right here. Okay. Throw yourself upon it.
And, you know, besides the movie that everyone except the blind people have seen, countless television shows also pay homage to the story. Current popular shows are included in this, such as Futurama, South Park. You know, it's a story that a lot of culture, pop culture right now, even though it was written 70 or so years ago, will still reference. And it also inspired a book, Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, a novel written in 1995 by Gregory Maguire.
And he's got a series, too. There are actually 3 or 4 books in his reimagined Oz series now.
Huh. Oh. I should actually get to read that. I didn't know that. Well, this novel, it was taking the story, well, not exactly the story, but the worlds and the characters of the original Wizard of Oz, and kind of flipping around, going earlier to before the time of that book, and taking a look at the world from the point of view of Elphaba, the Wicked Witch. And it was very well received, so much so that popular, well-known composer Stephen Schwartz.
Bastard. We have history with Stephen Schwartz for all you listeners out there who aren't play crafters.
Oh, Stephen Schwartz.
You and your children of Eden.
I'm not a play crafter, so I have no problem with him.
You will. We'll make you perform all his works.
He hates monkeys.
I don't like him.
There you go.
And besides hating monkeys, he also convinced Universal Pictures to make this Wicked into a musical, the wildly popular and aptly titled Wicked, which I actually just recently saw myself and I would very much recommend seeing.
Oh, you recommend me watching Wicked!
I do, except not with that voice.
So, I mean, so it's still good now, but how was it when it first came out?
Well, it was actually met very positively by critics upon release. It was praised for its appeal to young readers, as well as children who couldn't read yet. So for the parents to read the story, it was a very well-received book at the time. Besides the story, it was also praised for the quality of the illustrations that were with it. It had very little critical analysis in the first 50 or so years after its release. Although it did have some problems, around 1957, it was actually banned by the director of the libraries in Detroit.
Good.
They said it had, quote-unquote, no value to the children of today, or that day. It supported negativism, allegedly, and they said it brought children's minds to a cowardly level.
All of which are true. I can prove that.
Yeah.
Just take a look at this document.
Oh, he's got everything in order. All right.
Yep.
I light it on fire.
That is irrefutable proof.
I'm sorry to be doubting you.
Yep. Continue.
There was also some problems in 1986 when its inclusion in the public school syllabus was opposed by fundamentalist Christian families in... Oh, I forgot to write this down. In Tennessee. They said it...
Where else?
Right, naturally.
In Tennessee, Alabama, so...
Oh, man, we just lost our listeners from there. they claimed it was for depicting benevolent witches. Well, not claimed, because it did depict benevolent witches. And promoting that integral human attributes were individually developed rather than God-given. So it did receive some criticism. It was under some fire by different groups or so.
Right, but they were all stupid.
Of course. There go our troll fundamentalist face? Christian listeners.
Troll face.
We're trolling the fundamentalist Christians.
Yes, because everyone knows the fundamentalist Christians were such a large part of our listenership.
Naturally.
God hates troll faces.
Then why did God make the troll face?
That's a good point.
Oh, God made everything.
Alright, so how do you think it holds up after all this time, Eric?
Well, I mean, it really is the stuff of legend. Everyone pretty much knows this story. Although I gotta say, the impact of Wicked kind of tells two conflicting stories about it. People could argue that while it's keeping the legacy of this story in mind, while it's keeping it in everyone's hearts, it also might be saying, because they're dealing with it in a different way, that maybe it was about time for a change. Maybe it's time to go to another point of view in the story and change the story up a little for current times.
I think it was just to make money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, from my understanding of it, the original series of novels were supposed to be a populist parable about the potential of America. And I think what Gregory Maguire did was he pointed out that there were problems with that vision. You know, there were issues of racism and classism happening in America at the time and today. Right. Sorry, I tried to be deep.
Money! Well,
it makes sense, though, because while the story lives on for us today, there were things, given the time that was written, that, you know, could use changing, like what you just said.
You mean the racism?
The racism. I'm not a big fan. I'm going to go on record and say I don't like racism. I'm taking a stand.
That's a bold statement.
And the robber barons, and you know, taking advantage of the workforce.
Well, wait. You don't like robber barons or taking advantage of the workforce?
If I was a robber baron, I think then I would be okay with
it. I didn't realize barons. Ryan was such a communist.
No,
seriously.
We're getting rid of all these viewers. Our racist viewers.
Great. So in like 5 minutes, we've lost our fundamentalist Christians, our racists, our workers, and our robber baron listeners.
I think we're going to be the only ones listening.
I am really sorry to all of the robber barons out there.
Oh, Tennessee. All of Tennessee is gone.
Here's a topical reference for you. I hope you die in the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire.
I won't, because I'm a robber baron. I wouldn't be there.
Son of a bitch.
Right.
My buildings have fire
escapes. The IWW will take you down.
All right, let's stop making oblique historical references and keep going.
However, seeing how many television shows there are right now, how many current shows they're still spoofing or otherwise referencing the story, it kind of makes it clear that the story still has its place, even over 100 years after it was written. So, That's what I got.
Well, we made it through an entire discussion of L. Frank Baum's The Wizard of Oz without discussing
Zardoz.
Zardoz or The Wiz.
Oh, yeah. The Wiz.
The Wiz.
There was that.
Yeah,
well, now
that
we
happened.
Did.
And nope. Zardoz happened, too.
Yep.
And now that we've discussed them, let's move on to Meyer.
Yes. Let's never bring up Zardoz again.
So, what I watched was the first sci-fi movie ever made, but it's not. It wasn't really. Other movies came before it, but it's definitely was the most popular.
It was an early example.
Yeah. Which was A Trip to the Moon.
Oh, sounds nice.
It was pretty...
I'd like to go on a trip to the moon.
I don't... I'm not sure about that.
But I wouldn't like to be banished there.
Yeah. So it was a silent black and white movie which was written and directed by the French filmmaker Georges Méliès and his brother Gordon. So Méliès was also an illusionist, so he was really known for his use of special effects and stuff. And the movie, when it came out, it was voiced over in French. I watched the version on YouTube, which was a guy did voiceover in English.
Oh, it sounded like you're about to give a description of what YouTube was.
I watched it on YouTube, which is this website where you can post videos.
The movie was loosely based on two popular titles at the time, From the Earth to the Moon by Jules Verne, and The First Men in the Moon, which was by H.P. Wells. The basic plot of the movie was that there are scientists who, for some reason, dress up as wizards.
Makes sense. Well, they're science wizards.
They get handed these six telescopes by some lovely ladies, which I guess is the first hot ladies in sci-fi babes.
Oh. Okay.
So this council of wizard astronomers, they discuss a plan to go to the moon. So there's like the head guy, and he was like, so pointing up and making this moon, and all of a sudden this one wizard guy disagrees, and like arguments happen, books get thrown.
Wow. You don't mess with space wizards.
No. But then so five wizards, I'm gonna keep calling them wizards because in the beginning they look like wizards.
Because they are.
They decide to join the head wizard for a trip on the moon. And some guys made this rocket which was just the shape of a bullet. It was definitely too small for all six of these people to get into. And so this Bullet Bill rocket gets shot out of, like, this cartoonishly large cannon.
Man, why didn't we do this in the 60s?
And so it shoots it. And so this bullet goes into the moon, which literally has a face, and gets shot in the moon's eye.
Poor moon.
And that's kind of an iconic image, really, of that.
Yeah, the moon getting hit in the eye. I remember in film class, I remember how they filmed that, was they got a guy, poor bastard, and they literally just covered his face in shaving cream.
And then they literally shot him in the eye. Yeah.
And so they shoot. So then it lands, they walk out of the rocket. They can just breathe the oxygen like it's okay.
Yeah, it's the moon.
Yeah. And so they look around the train and look at the earth. They go, "Oh, that's nice." And then all of a sudden, there's... Oh, by the way, because in his own movie. So they're looking at it, and all of a sudden I realize, because they do these weird, like, they put their hands up in the air, and then all of a sudden their rocket just disappears. And I'm like, wow, they knew magic. Their rocket just disappeared.
It's science magic.
Yep. So anyway, so they decide that they want to walk around the moon, and all of a sudden there's an explosion. I don't know where it happened. And then they decided, I'm tired. So they pull blankets from somewhere and decide to go to sleep.
Moon explosions are tiring.
Man, very fatigued.
So while they're sleeping, a comet comes by, which is like, oh, that's nice. And then also the Big Dipper appears, but all the stars have women's faces on them, and they're looking at them.
That's really creepy.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, three things appeared. One of them is a girl who is supposed to represent the Greek deity Phoebe, who's associated with the moon. Mm-hmm. So she's sitting on a crescent moon. And
she's there. Wait,
crescent moon
the
on
view,
the moon.
The yeah. view from the moon, they could see a moon from.
Well,
so the moon has a moon.
Well, it might be from Saturn, because another thing they see is an old man who's looking out a window, and he lives in Saturn, so it's a window, huge window in Saturn that he's looking out of.
That's a real thing.
Yeah, and Saturn has lots.
Must
of
be people. A huge man because he could fit in Saturn.
Yeah. Saturn is a prime real estate.
Location. Well, lots of things could fit in
well,
Saturn.
Well, no, I mean, like he was like almost as big as Saturn.
Oh, okay.
And
oh.
Then also there's two like ladies holding up a star together.
I wish space was really like this.
It was really, so anyway. Phoebe doesn't like them. So these scientists for some reason, and so she makes it snow on these guys.
On the moon.
On the moon.
Yep. Like it does.
Yeah. So they run in, they run away from the... Because I guess they're going to be cold. So they run into this crater.
Well, it's moon snow. It's all.
Yeah. And the crater's filled with these giant mushrooms.
On the moon.
So this,
on the moon.
Yeah, on the moon. This one guy grabs an umbrella. One of his umbrellas, his umbrella turns into a huge mushroom and grows. And then they meet... aliens, and I'll leave it there.
All right. So, what's going to happen to the wizard mages astronauts on the moon with the aliens and the guy?
Oh, you can watch it on YouTube and find out yourself.
Yeah. It's only 10. It was 11 minutes.
All this stuff in 11 minutes.
Wow.
So, as you can tell, it's just weirdness, French weirdness. Anyway,
Méliès did a lot of strange things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he made one movie about just inflating a giant inflatable head that was just him.
The significance of the movie, as I said, it was one of the first sci-fi movies. For its time, it had really good special effects. And when Méliès decided he wanted to make a profit and stuff, of course, and he was going to distribute it to the United States. Unfortunately... one of Thomas Edison's film techs got this movie and made copies of it and distributed throughout America. So he made no money on it, and he went bankrupt because of it.
Wow, that sucks.
Yeah. Damn you, Edison! Yet another thing.
And
I had to
see,
be
that's why piracy is bad.
I guess it's one of the first things of copyright issue. I guess,
and that is why Nikola Tesla's corpse will one day rule the world. Yeah.
So, while this movie was a huge success, and it still is, it's, you know, people can consider it, you know, one of the best movies ever, you know, like, well, yeah, of all time. Maybe, I would say maybe one of the most influential movies. I'm not sure it was good. but, it you know, he, as I said, he went bankrupt and didn't make much money. But does it hold up now? As I described, it's based... Basically, the shots and scenes are amusing. As I said, the well-known image of the moon with the bullet in his eye. It tells a story. It just doesn't do a very good job at the story. I like watching old movies, so I still enjoyed it. And I'm sure people will enjoy it. It's weird. It's funny. And it's only about 10 minutes long. And, yeah. That's...
I'll put a link to it on... I'll embed the video.
It's... Yeah,
that sounds like something you might want to watch high.
Yeah,
I think you think you're high when you watch it.
Oh, okay.
It was the 2001 of 1902.
All right. Well, I had the pleasure of reading some Lovecraft for this.
We've covered fantasy. Now we move on to cosmic horror.
Oh, sci-fi.
Well, Lovecraft actually—it's hard to surmise what he did because he wrote dozens of stories during his lifetime. But what he's most really known for is his horror writing. He did some journalistic work and poems and other short stories too, but it's his horror writing which pretty much created and defined the entire literary genre of horror.
Oh, I thought he was known for his romantic comedies.
Well, that too.
Along came Cthulhu.
You've got Yog-Sothoth.
Sleepless in the City of the Great Race. All right, we need to make note of those.
Future titles.
Yeah. But you see, Lovecraft's work didn't focus on, like, the monsters that he wrote about. And he created some really memorable monsters, like Cthulhu, but his monsters were almost always referred to obliquely and without much detail. They weren't the centerpiece of what he was writing. What he was really writing about were the effects that these monsters had on people. A lot of his stories dealt with men delving into madness after encountering the otherworldly horrors that Lovecraft envisioned. And nearly all of his stories were told in the first person, and they were all about men, because Lovecraft, as great a writer as he was also incredibly racist and misogynistic. and that sometimes shone through in his work. So all of his main characters were pretty much single men or widowers or, you know, young scholars who just didn't mention women at all. Just never came up. There was no sex in Lovecraft's work. And if he had his way, there wouldn't be black people either. His stories were usually the accounts of these men explaining how they slowly stumbled upon some otherworldly horror or another. And his most famous story, The Call of Cthulhu, is an example of that. It's one man recounting about how he inherited something from his uncle, which led him into this whole otherworldly, horrible Cult of Cthulhu thing. And a lot of Lovecraft's work is actually inspired from his life. He was born on August 20th, 1890, in Providence, Rhode Island, to his father, Winfield, and his mother, Sarah. And apparently his mother could trace her lineage back to the original settlers of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which I thought was pretty cool. But when he was a young boy, when he was about 3 years old, Lovecraft's father went mad and died about 5 years after that, when Lovecraft was 8. So he was raised by his mother and his grandfather.
With the best name ever.
Best name in the world. Whipple Van Buren Phillips.
My son is going to be named Whipple Van Buren Phillips if I ever find a woman who's blonde enough to have one with me.
I thought Benedict Cumberbatch had a pretty good name.
No, I think Whipple Van Buren Phillips de Cash would be a better name.
What?
Now, it was Lovecraft's grandfather who encouraged his reading, because apparently Lovecraft was also somewhat of a prodigy. He was reading and writing when he had a very young age. And he also sparked his interest in weird stories by telling him original tales of Gothic horror that his grandfather came up with. And it's also believed that when he was a young boy, Lovecraft suffered from night terrors, often saying that he was being attacked by, quote, night gaunts.
Which all makes sense now.
Yeah, which is believed to heavily influence his future writing, and even he wound up writing a story about night gaunts.
If I recall correctly, he wrote a lot of short stories that were just, like, sort of his dream journals.
Yeah, which tells you just how fucked up in the head he was.
Jesus.
In the early 1910s, Lovecraft was mainly writing poetry, but it was in 1917 when he really began to write some fiction in earnest. In 1924, he married and moved to Brooklyn, but he and his wife slowly grew apart. She eventually moved to Detroit or Chicago, I believe, to get work because he couldn't get anything. And while he was living in Brooklyn alone, he started to hate New York. Eventually, he and his wife got divorced, and he moved back to Providence, which is when that was like the most prolific period of his life, but he just got poorer and poorer because he was selling his works, but not making a lot of money. And then he was diagnosed with cancer of the small intestine in 1936 and died a year later.
So good life.
Yeah, that's why he wrote so many romantic comedies. Yeah. He was just so happy all the time. But as for his influence on geek culture today, I mean, where do you start? It's just too much to count. If you've seen a horror movie or played a scary video game, read a Stephen King novel or a creepy comic book, chances are you owe some thanks to Lovecraft for that. He pretty much created the genre of horror. And although he called his writing weird fiction, today it would most likely be called psychological horror. That's what he went with. And that's pretty much what he created. Stephen King, who people, you know, is like the king, you know, of horror these days.
King.
He called Lovecraft the 20th century's greatest practitioner of the classic horror tale. He also said, King and many other artists have been influenced by Lovecraft's work, including Clive Barker, Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, Mike Mignola, John Carpenter, Stuart Gordon, Guillermo del Toro, the horror manga artist Junji Ito, and artist H.R. Giger. You know, the psychological thing that he developed was a lot like, you know, If Dead Space, the video game, is a good example. Mm. It's very Lovecraftian.
Eternal Darkness.
Oh, very. Even more so. Eternal Darkness, Sanity's Requiem, is almost a ripoff of Lovecraft. And in recent years, Lovecraft's fan base, I would say, has only grown even more than it was, with more and more people discovering his stories and the dark, twisted world that he created that sort of existed parallel to our own, just things happening in the shadows that you never really know about unless you look for them, which is always ends badly. However, as popular as he is now, Lovecraft was definitely one of those artists who didn't get a great reception at the time. He was often published in the weird fiction magazines of his day, but no one really knew his name. No one knew H.P. Lovecraft as an author. And he died a pauper. You know, he was the Van Gogh of horror stories. But not Van Gogh.
The one thing that did get his name out there, though, was he had a very healthy correspondence with pretty much the next generation of horror writers.
And that's true.
He got them all on board with his Cthulhu mythos, August Derleth, Robert Bloch, people like that.
Yeah, they carried his torch forward, but it took a while for him to really become, you know, the icon that he is now. But as far as how it holds up today, it's surprisingly good. You know, if you're reading it, there are definitely some old-fashioned phrases in Lovecraft's work, but not really enough to give the reader much pause. Most of his work, however, I would say, is sort of lost its bite. Unless you have an incredibly vivid imagination, it's hard to be scared by some of Lovecraft's work. I mean, if you're a fan of scares in this day and age, Lovecraft probably isn't going to be where you get them.
Is it hard not to be scared?
What?
Well, I would say it's hard not to be scared by Lovecraft's work.
I mean, it depends on how good you are in envisioning things, because some of them just aren't as scary these days.
I guess I just have a good imagination.
Well, I mean, there are some stories I've read that definitely creep me out, like The Music of Eric Zahn and The Color Out of Space. I still get shivers thinking about The Color Out of Space.
Lovecraft is the master of not showing you something and letting you fill in the blanks.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, he never really talks about the monster so much. He'll like, describe it vaguely as something with tentacles and sort of a fungoid appearance, but he definitely just gives you like a blank box and lets your brain fill in the horrible, horrible details.
That's what my brain does.
Yeah, Meyer's brain is pretty horrible. But if you...
That's what the doctors say.
Waka, waka, waka.
I need a CAT scan.
Okay.
But, I mean, Lovecraft for me, I was never a big fan of horror until I started reading Lovecraft, and now I've come to appreciate it more, especially psychological horror. So, I mean, if you like that, you know, tense psychological thrillers and horror, like John Carpenter's The Thing is a really good example of that sort of tense atmosphere that Lovecraft can build. And if you like that, you should read At the Mountains of Madness, which also takes place in the Arctic. It was sort of an influence for that work. It's definitely worth a read. So, I mean, if you like things like that, Lovecraft is still a fantastic read, as long as you can get around his racism and misogyny.
Well, I've already stood out against racism, so I can't.
Already lost a racist.
Not every story is bad, but,
I've heard it said that, you know, the monsters in his stories are just that, that kind of xenophobia that he exhibited, the fear of the other taken to its ultimate extreme.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of his monsters, too, I mean, he was sort of a pioneer of science fiction in a way, because most of his monsters were actually aliens.
Right.
He never went into extreme detail about where they came from, but he did talk about these great old ones coming from the stars and populating Earth. So, I mean, they were technically aliens.
And he was one of the first people who didn't hold with anthropomorphic monstrosities and deities.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, all of his monsters, as you said, were aliens who were completely alien in every sense of the word. They had very little resemblance to anything.
Which sort of increased the horror of it, you know, that something was just so foreign that it's hard to make sense of.
I really like that he wouldn't leave so many details of it, because you see lots of different people going, like, you give them a Lovecraftian monster and different people interpret it in completely different ways.
Right.
I just really like that about how he did that work.
I mean, the only ones I can think of that have somewhat concrete physical descriptions are Cthulhu and the ancient race, the big cone people.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, I can't remember him giving any like real concrete physical descriptions of things or aliens. He did places a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What were you going to talk about, Ryan?
Well, I read A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs. One of the early examples of pulp sci-fi, very popular pulp sci-fi.
Gotta love pulp.
Yeah, and my god, is this pulpy?
Me neither.
To give you a basic idea of what the story is, prospector and ex-Confederate Civil War veteran John Carter finds himself inexplicably transported to the planet Mars after taking refuge from an Indian war party in a mysterious cave.
Don't you hate when that happens?
It's the worst day.
Basically, he walks into this cave and something overcomes him, so he's paralyzed. And he's just lying on the floor, staring out the entrance of this cave at the Arizona desert. And he sees the planet Mars. And by some force of will, he wills himself to the planet Mars.
That's a bad day. Oh, God, I'm being chased. Oh, God, I'm in a cave. Oh, God, I'm paralyzed. Oh, God, I'm on Mars.
Is this the John Carter thing from Disney's doing now?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
See, that's kind of like what happened to me. I was taking a walk through the woods once, and I tripped and fell. And when I stood up, I was on Venus.
Oh.
Oh.
You should be careful. The pressure on Venus will kill you.
It did.
Also, they have sulfuric acid clouds.
Yes, they do.
Oh.
It was not a pleasant hike.
I mean, I knew Alex, though.
That's good.
And for some reason kept those memories for me.
You're welcome.
You are welcome,
sir. I don't sleep anymore.
No wonder why you wake up every night screaming, "The bucket of blood! The bucket of blood!"
No, that was from when I went to Jupiter.
Oh, I don't want to talk about Jupiter.
I show every clone of Alex's dead body.
I don't know why I entrusted Meyer with making my clothes. In retrospect, it was a very poor decision.
See, clone Alex, this is what you were before I made you.
Oh my god.
So anyway, he wills himself to the planet Mars, and he awakens in this field, which is the bottom of a dried seabed, and he's taken hostage by a nomadic race of green Martians known as Tharks, who are deeply impressed when he demonstrates his improved strength and agility that he manifests because Mars has lower gravity than Earth does. So his, you know, as an Earthman, his musculature can do really impressive things on Mars. Like, he can jump 130 feet in the air and, you know, knock out 11-foot-tall monsters with one punch.
He's Mars's Superman.
Yeah.
Ryan, you're going to have to investigate that, too.
All right. I'll will myself to Mars and ask John Carter.
If John Carter can do it, you can do it.
You're going to have a busy 2 weeks because we have another episode to record.
Yeah.
But he's probably still alive if there is a John Carter, because I forgot to mention and put that in notes. He's immortal.
Oh.
On Mars?
Everywhere.
Oh.
The whole thing is sort of told as a frame story, and the beginning is Edgar Rice Burroughs talking about his crazy uncle or something, who, you know, left him all these weird instructions in his will, and one of the instructions was a tomb with a lock on it that opens from the inside.
Huh.
So that he can leave. And in the beginning of his memoir that Edgar Rice Burroughs is supposedly publishing, he says that he doesn't remember ever being born or having a childhood. He was always just a man of 30 years old, and as far as he, you know, 20 or 30 years old, and as far as he can remember, he is several hundred years old.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah. So anyway, this immortal god guy, who can will himself across, you know,
vast distances.
Hundreds of millions of miles of space just by thinking about it, he hooks up with these green Martians who are sort of like a barbaric tribe of nomads.
Wait, I thought we were supposed to be writing about fiction.
You know, science fiction.
Oh.
Hard science fiction. He rescues a princess from the rival tribe, from the Tharks, and becomes embroiled in a war between the red and the green Martian races.
I hate when that happens.
And he eventually has to save them both from annihilation, because there's this whole thing with the atmosphere running out, and they have to fix it. It's a pretty good story. I'm not gonna.
It also sounds like an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie.
Yeah. So a little bit of background on Edgar Rice Burroughs. series was his brainchild. He was a Chicago native. He didn't actually start writing until he was 36. He was almost 40 years old when he first started writing.
Wow.
He came from a well-to-do Chicago family, and they sent him to like all of the best East Coast prep schools. But he failed the entrance exam at West Point, so he didn't go to college. and he spent the next 2 decades of his life pretty much wandering between low-paying, odd jobs. When he hit upon the idea of writing for pulp magazines, because he started reading the stories, and they were awful. And he thought, well, fuck, I can do this. And he did it, and apparently he did it quite well. Let's see. His first story, which was A Princess of Mars, was serialized in... I think it was like the All Fiction magazine. I have it somewhere in here. It was retitled Under the Moons of Mars, and they paid him $400 for it, which, according to Wikipedia, equates to $8,900 if adjusted for today's money.
Damn.
Wow.
So, first shot out of the box.
That's good.
$9,000 equivalent to today's money. I don't think I could do that.
I can pay for my gas for a week.
So after that happened, you know, he said goodbye to the, you know, prospecting or whatever the hell it was he was doing.
Bye, standing around with a stick. I got $400.
I could go buy more sticks and make them stand around with each other.
He decided to devote himself to writing full-time. The John Carter series remains a popular staple of science fiction. He's also known for creating Tarzan. He wrote the Tarzan books.
There's monkeys in that book.
He even managed to retain his badassery later in life. In the early 1940s, he was living in Hawaii when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And even though he was, like, 68 years old, he became a war correspondent.
Damn.
That's pretty old for that time.
And a lot of people have cited Edgar Rice Burroughs and the John Carter series as influences, like Robert A. Heinlein. He references the work heavily in his novel Number of the Beast, as well as in the rest of his Future History series. Which are all really great books. You hear a lot of people talking about how they read A Princess of Mars and the rest of the John Carter novels as kids, and it inspired them to go on do great works like Ray Bradbury. Carl Sagan, I think, got him interested in the cosmos.
And then he hosted a show called Cosmos.
Yes. John Carter is the prototypical pulp hero. He's a cunning warrior, a southern gentleman, an outsider. And thanks to the difference in gravity between Earth and Mars, empowered with the ability to jump 150 feet in the air and basically be a badass. And like I said, he's immortal, so there's that.
And he can will himself to Mars.
His love interest, the princess of Helium called Deja Thoris, is the quintessential leading lady of pulp. She's fiercely proud, alluring, and very naked.
Naked's good.
That's the thing about the people on Mars is even the ones that aren't anthropomorphic, they don't dress except for jewels. So if you can picture like the hottest woman you've ever seen with like light red copper skin wearing nothing but gems.
So I think I can work with that. You just sold me on this Disney movie.
I think they might change a little bit for the Disney movie.
Lose the jewels.
No, lose the copper skin. They have to whitewash everything.
Okay, yeah, right.
And the other thing is she's taken captive by a succession of villains.
Well, wouldn't you take her captive?
Yes. I would call this novel and the series that followed the progenitors of many of the different sci-fi and fantasy tropes that dominated those genres in the century to come. Probably not the only sources. He was probably working with a lot of stuff that was already present at the time, but it's all definitely there. Many of Burroughs' ideas about Marv derived from Mars, not Marv.
About the guy from Home Alone?
Yes. His ideas about Daniel Stern's character from Home Alone. The man was really prescient.
But he never read the story Under the Moons of Marv.
The Moons of Marv.
Oh man, we've got so much gold to mine from this episode.
My advent upon Marv, I got hit in the face with a brick.
And as I was lying unconscious, a hot iron fell on my face.
Anyway, so many of the ideas that he used in these novels are corruptions of the scientific writings of Percival Lowell, who was an astronomer who proposed that water might once have flooded the barren canals on the surface of Mars. While the series is by no means hard sci-fi, Burroughs does an excellent job of taking the contemporary scientific understanding of Mars and taking it a step further, you know, asking, what would it be like if we could visit Mars? And he doesn't worry about, you know, firing giant bullets out of cannons. It's just pure force of will. I want to go to Mars, and God damn it, now I'm there.
I'm sorry, every time you say Mars now, I think of
Marv.
Harry! I've reached the top!
Hey, I'm okay now.
Reception at the time... even though Burroughs published it under a pseudonym, because he was kind of trepidatious about it, he didn't think that the story would stand up to popular scrutiny, but they paid him a whole shit ton of money for it, and it became an instant hit. It achieved very high sales record in the magazine's history.
Nice.
As far as today, how does it hold up? The prose of the novel is deftly crafted and not too difficult to follow, although there are a few antiquated turns of phrase here and there. You know, like you said, it's pretty much the same thing about Lovecraft.
Yeah.
The Princess of Mars is primarily a pulp action story, so there's plenty of sex and violence, and it's all lucidly and fluidly described. The story itself is engaging and well-paced, and the novel itself makes for a pretty quick read.
Emphasis on the fluids.
I don't get it. I'm 12.
I'll explain semen to you later.
Like Lovecraft, I have to say the author's sensibilities are most certainly of another era. I'd call it racist, but that would be unfair, I think, to judge the portrayal of certain groups of characters in the novel by the social standards of the current century.
See, whereas Lovecraft was just racist.
And as far as how well it stands up, as Meyer pointed out, they're making a movie, so obviously it must still be kicking around.
Yeah.
I think that this might just be because the U.S. copyright on the series recently expired. So it could just be that Disney was looking for some free IPs to pick up and turn into, you know, whitewashed.
Does that mean that people can get these online for free, the books?
I think they're on Project Gutenberg. I bought the entire series from Amazon Kindle for 99 cents.
Sucker.
Sucker.
Sucker. I'm joining the crowd.
Oh, that's it. It's not cool anymore.
No one calls people suckers anymore.
I've been saying sucker since before it was popular.
Yeah, right.
Donning
my hipster shades.
Anyway, so when we come back, we're going to have some awesome voicemails that we've gotten from our listeners, which we have.
we totally do.
We have temporaries.
Well, until this episode airs.
For those of you who have been listening, all one of you.
hey, this proves that we have more than one.
That's true.
We have at least four.
We have some horrible, horrifying listeners.
No, that we know.
As you'll soon see. We promised that if any one of you called us up and left us a voicemail, we would give you a free comic book. And
which we haven't done so
far. We have not done that.
But we also promised that we'd play your voicemails on air.
And that's what we're about to do right now.
Right, because we haven't done that yet either.
We're fulfilling the part that doesn't require us to give stuff of ours away.
Well, we do have lots of free comics to give away. We just have to actually give them away.
Yeah, right now we're following the path of least effort.
Yeah.
All right. So our first voicemail is from a longtime listener, Derek.
Let's listen.
Hey guys, it's Derek. It's the day after you posted your show to iTunes. I just let it get to listen to it. And I wanted to say thank you. Thank you for finally giving me a shout out. You know, I'm your biggest fan. I post on your Facebook. And finally giving me a chance to talk to you. You mentioned me on the app. Now the next step we have to do is work.
The protector.
This is 15 hours, I think.
I need a new one. My old one is essential.
Remember, pool is not the floor, just the floor. Isn't the floor?
Wow, that was a good one.
It's not done. Yep, it's not though. It's not over.
Oh.
Now it's over.
All right.
Oh wow, that was a good one.
Oh man.
I think there was a death threat in there somewhere.
My favorite part was where he forgot to hang up the phone.
Yeah, that was good. I could swear I heard him say, "I'll call later," and then he must have just put the phone in his pocket and then went and talked to someone.
That was a good one, but not nearly as good as our next voicemail.
Thanks, Derek. You're going to get a free comment.
Eventually, when we get around to it, which may or may not happen.
So our
it will.
Next...
It will. We said so.
Probably.
Yes. Reasonably sure that it will happen at some point in the future.
Like 78% sure.
Well, now 75.
We're not going to say the comic's a good comic, though.
No. And it may just be a cocktail napkin with a picture and a word bubble on it.
This is a comic.
C-O-M-E-K. Comic.
X.
Anyhow, so, now that we've heard from Derek, let's hear from one of our other favorite listeners.
Hello?
Okay.
You know, that does sort of bring up an existential question, though. When are we going to Grandma's house?
I don't know,
but man, I really want to go. It's been a while since I've been to Grandma's house.
I think it's, I got to work on my language when I know babies are watching us.
And yeah. That was clearly a baby just button mashing on a phone that dialed our voicemail.
What are you talking about, Ryan? That was clearly a young fan who loved our show and wanted to express it
by not saying anything. I would call that baby a wunderkind. A child prodigy.
I would call that baby delicious.
Baby?
Oh, Alex, you didn't.
I'm not at liberty to discuss that.
Oh.
Baby, we'll give you that comic if we know who you are.
So when you grow up and you reach the age of 18, drop us an email and we'll give you a comic.
That's not going to be happening.
Not at all.
Maybe it will. Let's be optimistic.
Anyway, here is where our emails, our voicemails, excuse me, sort of take a dark and disturbing turn. Let me start that over again. Here's where our voicemails take a dark and disturbing turn. Thank you, Coach Z.
Thank you, Ryan, for that 3-year-old Homestar Runner reference.
I think it's funny that a baby was our high point.
Well, here we go. From here, we're down in the depths.
Not just that, a butt dialing, baby.
Mm-hmm. All right, guys. Just sitting here, eating acid. I mean, drinking acid. Eating pizza. Losing the show. You guys doing good? Yeah. Just thought you'd like to know. Also, sitting here naked. As I sit here, drinking acid. Eating pizza. Mm-hmm. Pizza. Mm-hmm. All right. Later, guys.
Oh, my God.
He said he was naked.
That was imagination, Will, everybody.
Listening to that, I'm pretty sure he hung up the phone so he can go fuck that pizza.
That was pizza. Imagination, Will. This is a problem if he's listening.
Now, Imagination Will is not like our friend Will. He's the horrible cartoon version of Will. He enjoys drinking acid and eating pizza, and apparently also eating acid.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't question his ways.
No.
He will rape us.
He'll do terrible stuff.
Or just want
to
play...
Gang raped to death?
Gang raped to death?
I'm still waiting for that techno remix.
If any of our fans are fans of also Ghost Adventures, I just always call it Ghost Bros. That's why I got hung up for a second. There's one episode where they visit a prison and Zach says, gang raped to death? Make an awesome techno remix, if any of you are so inclined.
Gang raped, gang raped,
gang raped to death?
Why don't we do
waka, waka.
It?
We did make that awesome Ragnarok theme.
We were very talented with that one.
We did. All right, but there's no way that the next voicemail can be as bad as Imagination.
No, it's impossible.
Let's give it a listen.
Hello, Dev. Is it Dev? Okay, it's Dev. Okay. Come on, we're gonna take care of the Dev. My wife would like to use the toilet.
Oh my Christ.
Did Papa Lazaru call us and leave us a voicemail?
I think he did.
I'm gonna go live in my bunker now.
He'll find you.
I know.
He always finds you.
Now I want to see a fight between Papa Lazaru and Imagination Will.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, God. I don't. That means I have to be close to both Papa Lazaru and Imagination Will.
I wonder who would win, but I also wouldn't want to stick around to find out.
For those who don't know Papa Lazaru, he is from A League of Gentlemen, and he's horrifying.
Yes. Yes, he is. He's just awful. Good God, is he awful.
So, anyway, those were our voicemails. We had Derek, a button-mashing baby. Imagination Will and Papa Lazaru from League of Gentlemen.
That means that does kind of mean we had a celebrity appearance.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I just realized.
What?
We got to get Papa Lazaru and Imagination Will comics.
We'll mail them.
Not it.
Not it.
Ed's
doing it.
Sorry, Ed.
Ed's got this one.
Thanks for volunteering, Ed.
Anyway, so we've gotten 4 voicemails so far. We'd love to get more. We have plenty of free comics to give out, and we swear we'll give them out. We're reasonably sure about that.
Like 76%.
Yeah, 74. Anyway,
see, that's good.
If you want to call us, you can do so by calling 516-362-6373 or 516-362-NERD. Now, we'll repeat that again at the end of the show.
Because we'll roll like that.
Well, Ryan will, because none of us
can remember the number.
Because none of us fucking knows the number. All right, and that's all the time we have for episode 16.
Oh, man, I hope those Doomhounds are still watching.
Or being watched.
Oh, whichever way it is, goddamn, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
They're watching this podcast.
I think it's the ambiguity that's the most terrifying.
Yeah. Just like Lovecraft's work?
Exactly.
Just like. So anyway, if you have any pieces of nerd culture from the first 25 years of the 1900s that you would like to discuss, feel free to share your thoughts with us on our comment thread. You can like us on Facebook and talk to us there. You can send us an email at info@ragnarok.com.
Yep.
Or you can do what Imagination Will and Papa Lazaru did and
leave us a
terrifying voicemail.
Not a terrifying voicemail.
Yeah,
but
if you could, you know, dial down the terror a bit. We've already got quite a lot of terror in this show with all of the Lovecraft and Imagination Will. But you can do so by calling us at 516-362-6373. That's 516-362-NERD.
Yeah, that's Ryan with the numbers.
Yeah, number Ryan.
And we actually, if you would like, you can go on iTunes and download our podcast there. We actually have a review.
We do?
We do.
How many, what did we get?
We got 4 out of 5 stars.
Whoa.
Derek.
Ah. Thanks, Derek. Couldn't do 5 out of 5. You are a real dipshit.
That could be why he knocked off that one star.
Yeah.
Well,
we haven't gotten his comic yet.
I'm gonna keep saying
that's true. That one comic.
Apologize to him. Maybe he'll give us that star.
This is we're at a standstill. He gives us 5, or he's gonna be a dipshit.
Okay, how about this, Derek? If you give us that 5th star, we'll let you have sex with Ed.
I think
or we'll 2 stars. Or we will stop Ed from having sex with you. No, whichever one is more appealing for you is the one that will happen.
Yeah.
And Ed agrees completely with us. Yep. You could tell from his emphatic nodding.
At least he would.
I've never seen anyone nod that much.
He will agree once we figure out how to put him back together again.
Well, yeah, but we've got the suitcases, so it can't be that hard.
I think I've got the instructions somewhere.
Oh, wait. Are they IKEA instructions?
Yeah, I think they are.
Oh, this is going to take a while.
So you'll see us and the Ed table at the next episode.
Where we'll be talking about the second part of our geek century.
1925 to 1950.
1926 to 1950.
That's right. Anyway, this has been Geek Century Part 1, or Watch of the Doomhounds. I'm Ryan.
I'm Eric.
I'm Meyer.
And I'm Alex.
And later. We're all kitty cats. Meow, 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 meow.
Looks like I'm going to have to put it back together myself. Someone pass me that.
One more time in your dream. A sweet lullaby is always more than it seems. What motivates you is the reason you cry. You're addicted to your life. A shadow of the goat follows you around. Migrating, listening to the sound. Trading long longing for a slice of the pie. Cause it gets you so high.
I'll pay ever so dearly with your soul. For the piper's call.
This is it for this incarnation, but you'll be resurrected in this coming resurrection. Not the end of your road, for your paths they will come.